Hi, I'm Nivi from VentureHacks, like Alvin said, I'm going to be talking about pitching, and I'm going to be talking mostly about pitching what you have, as opposed to having something worth pitching, though we're also going to talk a little bit about having something worth pitching. Just some coordinates before we start. Like I said, I'm from VentureHacks.com. You can find us on Twitter, at VentureHacks, if there's any tweeters here, and you're tweeting here during the course of the talk. I appreciate it if you use the #VH tag so I can find you, and I can find the comments, and you can always reach me at nivi@venturehacks.com. And I'll put some form of these slides on VentureHacks as well, so you don't need to, the slides are actually pretty sparse. So one thing I'd like to say about pitching is, even if you're not raising money, I think it's really important to have a concise and effective pitch. It's tough to recruit co-founders. It's tough to recruit employees, lawyers, accountants, customers, if you can't concisely and effectively pitch your company or your offering to them. And I'm going to basically just give this talk extremely quickly. It'll take about 2 minutes. Then I'll tell you a little bit about myself, and then I'll elaborate on the two-minute version of the talk. So based on the two-minute version, you can decide whether you want to stay or go. So here's the very short version of the talk. The premise is that when you're raising money, if you want to get good terms, you need to get multiple offers. If you want to get multiple offers, you need to go out and talk to several investors at the same time. And you need to tell them a story about your businesses. Ultimately, investors invest in stories. They don't really invest in businesses. And you need to be able to tell your story in a few words, you need to be able to tell it in a few paragraphs, and you need to be able to tell it during the course of a 20-minute presentation. You can tell the story about your company in all those ways, and startups have to do all three. So here's how you don't tell a story to investors or, frankly, to practically anyone. You don't send them a business plan. Nobody reads it. You come off as unsophisticated if you do, and sophisticated investors don't ask for them. Likewise, with an executive summary, you don't send an executive summary because nobody reads it and it comes off as unsophisticated. As far as asking for NDAs go, that is basically, again, a no-no. Nobody will sign one. So what do you need to tell a good story? First of all, you need a good intro. Typically, another entrepreneur or investor will introduce you to an investor. You need a high-concept pitch for your company. In a few words, describe your business. So one great high concept pitch is Flickr for video. Does anyone know what that is? What's the Flickr of video? What?
YouTube.
We'll take YouTube. So you can go and find a TechCrunch article in the archives from back in the day, 2006, before YouTube was a huge success, where they describe it as the Flickr of video. So what else do you need? You need an elevator pitch, which is about 100 to 150 words about your company that you put in writing over email or you present in person. And the elevator pitch is pretty straightforward. It talks about how great your team is, how great your product is, what your existing traction is, and your social proof. That is to say, such and such loves us. Eric Schmidt is an advisor to our business, or Rajiv Madhwani is an advisor to our business. And this is optional, but you can have a 10-slide deck that you present in about 20 minutes that you pass along when you send your elevator pitch to investors. It's not critical. It's a nice to have, but you'll probably end up working one up anyway. And finally, what you need, given that most people are going to get no's when they go and raise money, you need to figure out how to get past no. The best resource for that is an article by Mark Andreessen, a.k.a. P. Marca, that you can find on his blog at this tiny URL. And then if you want to learn more about this, stick around for the rest of the talk, or you can go and buy the book on VentureHacks.com. Sorry? Can you get it by Friday? Yeah, it's in PDF. So let me just tell you a little bit about myself. Yeah, just a little background on myself. So I'm an informal venture partner in a $22 million fund called the HitForge. Most people don't know the name of the fund, but if they would know anything about the fund, they'd know the main partner. His name is Naval Ravikant. He's the founder of ePinions. And we're in companies like Twitter, and we're in companies like Discuss. And Naval is also my partner on Venture Hacks. We co-author the articles together. Prior to that, I've just helped start a few companies. One of them is Songbird, which is backed by Sequoia. Their high concept pitch is the Firefox of media players, or you can think of it as an open source version of iTunes. I helped start my brother's company called Grokket, which is backed by Benchmark. Their high concept pitch is massively multiplayer online learning, like an MMOG, but for learning. Helped start a company called Covio. I was one of the inventors of the company of Covio's technology. They're backed by Kleiner, and they make printed computer chips. So like using laser printers or inkjets or stamping to print on computer chips. And I also informally advise a bunch of other startups. I've also worked on the venture side at Bessemer with David Cowan and a few other venture firms. And prior to that, I went to MIT for way too long, studying EECS, the building we're in right now. Okay, so I said I was going to talk about pitching what you have, not so much having something worth pitching, but let's briefly talk about having something worth pitching. And the word for that is traction. Another phrase that people use that Mark Andreessen likes to use is product market fit. It's a measure of the fit of your product with the marketplace. Let's just start off with a little quote. I think this is a good quote from Mark Hedlund from O'Reilly, who's also the CEO of a company, or at least the founder of Wasabi, which is backed by OATV and some other folks. For investors, the product is nothing. For entrepreneurs, the product is everything, usually. It's why you get up in the morning. It's the sexy part of the startup. It's the reason you started the company. But for investors, it's typically it's just one piece of the puzzle. And the most important piece of the puzzle for investors is traction. And like I said, traction is a measure of your product's engagement with its marketplace. And that's measured in order of preference through profit, then revenue, then through customers, then beta customers, then users, then proven hypotheses about your customers, and then through the rates of change of all of those things. And ultimately, any story you tell without talking about your traction is a work of fiction. And you really need to start building your product and testing it in the marketplace before going out to raise money. And if that seems impossible for your business, if you're saying to yourself, oh, we need $2 million to even build the first version of our product, what I would suggest is reducing the scope of what you're trying to do. Scope is the hidden fourth dimension that most people forget about or don't know about. You know, there's time, quality, cost, and people often say you can pick two. What you can actually do is you can pick all three if you also bring scope into play. So just reduce scope to the point where you can actually put something out into the marketplace. For example, if you have an enterprise product, consider putting together a PowerPoint presentation instead of putting together a product. Make a PowerPoint pitch and go and sell that to customers and see if they will sign an LOI to actually buy the product if you can deliver it to them. Or even see if you can take money out of their pocket based on the PowerPoint pitch. Or if you're in the consumer marketplace, buy AdWords, start testing testing some landing pages, and see what kind of information you can get from customers and see what kind of demand you can harvest based on your Google AdWords. So see if you can collect their names, their email addresses, their phone numbers. See if you can get them to even pay for the product before it's ready. So if you're wondering how you might do this, just the places to go to are Steve Blank has a great book called Four Steps to the Epiphany, which I would check out. That's very focused on the enterprise side of things. And if you're in the consumer side of things, there is a great blog by Eric Ries called Startup Lessons Learned, Eric, E-R-I-C, Ries, R-I-E-S, which talks about how you would essentially sell a product even before you build it. Just a few more words about traction. If you have incredible traction, it really doesn't matter how bad your product is or how bad your team is. You will be able to raise money, though a good team and a good product will improve your terms. If you have a medium amount of traction, a good team and a good product are critical. And if you have no traction, you either better have the most amazing demo in the world where people see it and they're like, whoa, their mind is blown, or you better have a pedigreed team, like our last company was sold to Google for $100 million kind of pedigree. Otherwise, don't raise money. Ultimately, just the last thing about traction, investors want to invest in companies that will succeed with or without them. And the companies that need the money most are the least likely to get it. But making something out of nothing is ultimately what entrepreneurs do. So let's talk. Any questions so far? And if anyone has any questions or comments, feel free to jump in. Thoughts, questions? Yeah.
I know it depends on what type of venture it is, but are there particular numbers in terms of like how many users or rate of growth that investors get kind of their ears perked up when they hear them?
Yeah, so I'm not sure I'm the right guy to answer that exact question. The first part is they're looking for rate of change, and maybe the rate of change over the specific absolute value. Two, like you said, it depends on the market, and my suggestion is just depending on the market, go and find out, for example, how quickly YouTube grew or how quickly Epiphany ramped up their enterprise sales, and see how you can compare yourself to that, and use that as a way to educate investors as well, that you are growing quickly. So that's as best as I can probably answer your question right now. Yeah.
How does traction translate to a clean tech that's building a fuel cell?
Yeah, good question. First, these are all guidelines, right? They don't apply in every situation. So in a clean tech startup, or let me give you another example instead. Like, for example, say we're inventing a cure for cancer. There's no real market. What?
It's the same thing.
Right. Right. So there's no real market risk associated with the cure for cancer, right? So it's all technology risk.
Yeah.
So if you go to investors and say, we have absolutely no meaningful contact with customers yet, but we have a promising cure for cancer and we'll know in 7 years whether or not it works, right? That's a fine story because there's no market risk. So the amount of traction you need to show people depends on the amount of market risk associated with your product. So if you can make the case for your clean tech product that the next guy in the supply chain, everybody knows he's going to buy it. And, for example, just like in the case of people that have cancer, they will buy the drug, right? They will find a way to buy the drug. They'll kill someone else to get the money to buy the drug. So if you can show that there's no risk in the next step in the supply chain, then you don't really need traction. So depending on the amount of risk, you need to show traction. So that can just be a conversation with the next guy in the supply chain. It could be an LOI from the next guy in the supply chain.
That was great.
Did I answer your question? Okay. Any other questions, comments before we... And is this material so far, is it relevant to where your heads are at? Or is it... Okay. Good. Okay, thumbs up. Any thoughts? Okay, good. We'll just keep going. So how do you get in front of investors? Through an introduction. And why do you need an introduction? This is a great quote from Chris Wand at Foundry Group, which is an investor in Zynga, for example, which you might know is a big social game platform. The VCs are generally bombarded by requests for meetings, so a warm introduction helps an entrepreneur's request float to the top of the list. That's about it. Investors are being asked for more meetings a day than they could fit in that day or that week or month or probably in their lifetime, right? So they use introductions to prioritize and filter requests for meetings. So my suggestion to you is to get a middleman to introduce you to investors. And the effectiveness of a middleman depends entirely on his relationship with the investor. And in general, the best, let's list the different types of middlemen from best to worst. The best is probably an entrepreneur that the investor has backed before or wants to back or is currently backing, right? The next guy on the list, number two, is a co-investor. So someone he's co-invested with, wants to co-invest with, or is currently co-investing with. Third on the list are industry luminary. Say, like, Eric Schmidt is going to introduce you to somebody, or Rajiv Madhwani at Stanford is going to introduce you to somebody. Fourth on the list are lawyers and accountants, and at this point, we're scraping the bottom of the barrel, unfortunately, and this isn't directed at any specific lawyer or accountant in the world. They just tend to not have very good deal flow. Fifth on the list are communists, and then sixth on the list is someone the investor met at a party once. And you'll run into those people as well. So like I said, this is a pretty generic list. The best thing to do is just to tease out exactly how that middleman knows the investor by asking them questions like, what deals have you sent the investor that he's subsequently done? How do you know him? Why are you interested in sending our company to the investor? And if they can't give you a good reason why they like your company and want to pass it along, they're kind of trolling. And there's a couple kinds of investor intros you want to avoid. One are, like I said, the sixth guy on the list, people that the investor met at a party once. If the intro email starts off with, I don't know if you remember me, but that's not a good intro. The other type of intro that you want to avoid is a middleman who is an investor who makes it a habit to invest in companies like yours, but for some not good reason is not going to invest in your company. So despite that long-winded way of saying it, that happens all the time, where an investor declines to invest in your company but says, oh, I'll introduce you to other investors. Those are generally useless unless the middleman has a really good reason why he's not investing. And they usually don't. So in that case, what I would do is ask the middleman, who do you want to introduce me to, and then go and find your own route to that subsequent investor, which you can do through LinkedIn, through your network, through Facebook, and so on. So how do you get introductions? It's not fun or sexy. It's just work, but it's pretty straightforward. So the first thing I would do is pick up the phone and start calling people who know you, who will listen to you, and who know investors. Don't send emails. It's not urgent enough. No one's going to pay attention. They'll end up at the bottom of their list. Pick up the phone, if this is important to you, and call everyone you know who owes you a favor. Call in all your favors. And explain to them why they will look good by making an introduction to an investor. The tools that you use are the same tools you use to pitch investors, a high concept pitch, an elevator pitch, which we'll talk about. And I would also say focus on getting that middleman on making just one intro. Don't have them make like three email introductions, which will come off as weak. Have them also pick up the phone and call an investor and say, this company is hot. They're moving quickly, et cetera, et cetera. You need to meet with them this week. And middlemen do that all the time for the right company. To that point, I would also say, if you're building something that's interesting, people will offer to introduce you to people. They will insist on it. In Hollywood, content is king, and in Silicon Valley, deal flow is king. So if you have a good company, people will offer to make intros. And the contrapositive of that is that if no one is willing to make intros, it's a good indication that your company is also not that interesting. And how do you get your company? So you may be at a point where your company is not yet that interesting, and that's fine. Every company in its lifetime was not that interesting at some point, or many points. So if you can't get an intro, my suggestions are to go back to the drawing board, go talk to your team and figure out how to take the company to a point where you can get intros, or perhaps this is not the right company for you. So go join a startup and work there for a few years so you can build the right connections and pedigree. Or go hang out in the lobby of a conference until you meet the right middlemen and advisors and investors. I've done that, and lots of people do that. Or go to your team and brainstorm about who you know who knows investors, right? So turn it into a team project. But the bottom line is that nobody said getting these introductions is going to be fast or easy. What I would suggest is if you do want to do this, I would focus on it and have somebody work on this task full time. So like we said, you convince investors and middlemen alike with a high concept pitch and with an elevator pitch. So let's talk a little bit about high concept pitches.
This is the more fun part of the presentation, maybe. And a high concept pitch is a short phrase or sentence that describes your company in a few words. So this is some good advice from Sequoia Capital. Summarize the company's business on the back of a business card. So Hollywood has really mastered the idea of a high concept pitch, and it comes from Hollywood, I think. At least I think it does. So here are some high concept pitches from Hollywood. If anyone recognizes them, please say so. It's Jaws in space. Does anyone know what that is? Alien. Good. The first one, not the second one. Alien. All right. A bus with a bomb. Okay. Good. You guys read ahead, I guess. Snakes on a plane. That's not a hard one. Bambi meets Terminator. Okay, I made that up. So every startup should also have a high concept pitch. So I'll throw out some high concept pitches for startups, and you tell me if you know what they are. Friendster for dogs. Okay, good. Flickr for video. We did. We Network Networks. All right. The Firefox of media players. Oh, you guys are listening. Good. Massively multiplayer online learning. All right. The entrepreneurs behind the entrepreneurs. That's not bad. It was Sequoia. I think that's Sequoia's trademarked tagline. Create your own social network. Venture hacks. Good. That's pretty self-descriptive. So what makes a good high concept pitch? Like we said, it's one short sentence or paragraph. Sorry, one short phrase or sentence. The audience should understand the building blocks of the pitch, so they should understand what JAWS and MMOGs and Firefox and things like that are. So what that means is the high concept pitch is going to depend to some degree on the audience. The other thing I would say is don't confuse your tagline with your high concept pitch. It's rare that they're the same thing. Your tagline speaks to your customers. So for example, YouTube's tagline is broadcast yourself. YouTube's high concept pitch speaks to their potential employees, investors, and the press. One bit of feedback that we tend to get on high concept pitches is that they're too simple, and it's true. They are too simple. That is, in fact, the point of a high concept pitch, is to simplify it. There's way too many startups vying for way too little attention for you to explain what your company does, to have the chance to explain what your company does in detail. So you use a very short pitch, like, we're the Flickr for video. And they say, oh, that's interesting. What the hell does that exactly mean? So it's the beginning of a conversation, not the end of one. And I would say, people also like to say that we can't describe this in a few words. My response to that would also be, if you can't describe the company in a few words, how is anybody going to describe your company to anybody else? Right, so it's a great tool for people to pass the word along about your company. A high concept pitch is also a great way to describe your product in the context of an elevator pitch. So let's talk a little bit about elevator pitches. But before we go on, any questions, comments, thoughts? Good. Okay. Let's talk about elevator pitches. Elevator pitches go on and on. Sorry, a bad elevator pitch goes on and on about the product. A good elevator pitch describes the product with just a simple high concept pitch and spends the rest of the elevator pitch talking about the team, your social proof, and your traction. So let's just look at an example of an elevator pitch that I put together based on a blog post that Mark Andreessen wrote about Ning. And I think it's a pretty good elevator pitch. So, subject line, introducing Ning to Blue Shirt Capital. Blue Shirt Capital is a hypothetical venture capital firm. Steve, thanks for offering to introduce us to Blue Shirt Capital. I've attached a short presentation about our company, Ning. Briefly, Ning lets you create your own social network for anything, for free, in 2 minutes. It's as easy as starting a blog.
try it at Ning.com. We built Ning to unlock the great ideas from people all over the world who want to use this amazing medium in their lives. We have over 115,000 user-created networks, and our page views are growing 10% per week. We previously raised $44 million from Legg Mason and others, including myself. Before Ning, I started Netscape, acquired by AOL for $4.2 billion, and Opsware, acquired by HP for $1.6 billion. Blue Shirt's investments in companies like Extensive Enterprises tell me they could be a great partner for Ning. We're starting meetings with investors next week, and I would love to show Blue Shirt what we're building at Ning. We'll come back to this, and we'll analyze this in a second. And it might seem that I may belabor the elevator pitch a little bit, but I think it's actually the prime piece of collateral for a startup. It's more important than your deck, more important than your business plan, which you don't really need anyway. So why do you make the elevator pitch? An introduction sells an investor on reading the elevator pitch. An elevator pitch sells the investor on reading a deck. And a deck sells an investor on taking a meeting. And if the intro and the elevator pitch are good, investors will just skim the deck, or they may not even read it, and they'll just take the meeting. A deck is just a 10-slide PowerPoint presentation. Sorry, I didn't explain it. And if you are going to cold call somebody, which you can do, I like cold calls if they're good cold calls. I've built good relationships off of cold calls. And you can cold call Mike Moritz if you want. His email address is on his website. And I know people who've cold called him and gotten a meeting. But if you're going to do that, your elevator pitch better be mind-blowing in form and content. So let's just analyze this elevator pitch. I've just annotated it with some stuff in bold. It's a little hard to tell the difference, but they're also in brackets, or whatever you call those, square brackets. So introducing Ning to Blue Shirt Capital. So the first thing is, this is a useful subject line. The number of elevator pitches that I get, cold calls that start off with the subject line of hello, is amazing. So start off with a useful subject line. Thanks for offering to introduce us to Blue Shirt Capital. There we're reiterating the social proof of the investor, of the middleman. The middleman is implicitly endorsing the company by making an introduction. I've attached a short presentation about our company name. There's a deck that you can take a look at. It's attached. Briefly, Ning lets you create your own social network for anything for free in 2 minutes. So right there, we've basically described, in very few words, under 20, I think, we've put a high concept pitch in there. We've described what the product is, what the customer is, who the customer is, what problem they have, and what problem we solve for them. It's as easy as starting a blog. Just give me a metaphor for trying to understand it. Try it at Ning.com. So you need to link to a product, a screencast, a screenshot, a mock-up, something. Like, God help you if you have nothing to show, because you will be ignored. This sentence is a little awkward, but I lifted it almost verbatim from his blog. We built Ning to unlock the great ideas from people all over the world who want to use this amazing medium in their lives. So what's just the big vision or opportunity here? Beyond dollars, we all want to make money. There's great traction. But all that aside, just why should I be compelled to be interested? How are you making the world a better place? Or how are you making an improvement? We have over 115,000 user-created networks, and we're growing at 10% per week. This is the key traction. We previously raised $44 million from Legg Mason. Again, a little bit more traction insofar as their ability to raise money. And social proof. These investors say we're good. Why don't you think we're good? Before Ning, I started Netscape, which was sold, and Opsware, which is also likewise sold. Teams past successes, the team's pedigree. So don't worry if you don't have the pedigree of Mark Andreessen. I don't think anybody in the room does. Just talk about the pedigree that you do have. Like, Stanford is a great bit of pedigree. Talk about if you've previously started a website that had 50,000 registered or active users, even though it blew up. That's great pedigree. Blue Shirt's investments in companies like Extensive Enterprises tell me they could be a great partner for Ning. That sentence is a little awkward. That's my fault. But why are you interested in this investor beyond the fact that they are just a pile of money? So you have to give them a reason why you want to talk to them. And we're starting meetings with investors next week, and I would love to show Blue Shirt what we're building at Name. It's a call to action. Again, the number of pitches that I get that don't have an explicit call to action is pretty incredible, where people just want to talk, or they don't even say they want to talk. Just ask me, tell me what you want. This is America. We don't need to beat around the bush. You can just be pretty direct about things. And there's a little bit of subtle scarcity in there as well, in the sense that if you don't talk to us soon, the deal's going to disappear. And then there's some useful contact information, which you'll also find missing from a lot of emails like this. And in general, I would say the email uses good grammar and spelling, punctuation, good English in general, which, again, you will find missing from a lot of elevator pitches. So I guess I would say when in doubt, just follow this template exactly. This is about 160 words, which I think is actually too long. Aim for about 100 words. And keep the product description brief. But I think the product description, including the sentence on a blog, is 29 words. And that's all I have to say about elevator pitches. The next thing is going to be a brief discussion on decks. But does anybody have any questions? Yep.
I think I had a misconception about an elevator pitch, mm-hmm. that you actually had to speak it. So this in writing is sort of you can sit and design the content as opposed to having to speak it verbatim.
Yeah.
I think that the whole idea of catching someone in an elevator and telling them this is different from having the leisure of writing it down.
So I think the common definition of an elevator pitch is the one that you're saying. It's something that you say in person. I think this is something that you can roughly say in per person, so you can draft it out. I would also say that I think this is a critical piece of getting a meeting. We don't need to call this an elevator pitch. We could call it an X, but I'm just calling it an elevator pitch because they're roughly the same content. But this is a critical piece of getting a meeting, I think, that is often missing. So I think this is the best way to get a meeting. This combined with a great introduction, for example, because even if you attach a deck, that's a click, right? People got a click, and your click-through rate is going to drop, substantially, maybe 10%, which is substantial, probably more 50%. So half the people that get the deck and an attachment aren't going to click through. So I want to put the information right in front of them. So I don't know if I answered your question or if even it was a question or a comment more so, but...
Yeah, I think there's more fear involved in having to speak.
Right, that's true. That is absolutely true. That's why I suggest perhaps working one out like this beforehand that you can mime and practice. Any other questions? Yep.
So how should the high concept pitch in the elevator pitch compare with the one that you're writing on the back of your business card?
I guess the one that's on the back of your business card is a high concept pitch, roughly. Like We Network Networks, where the entrepreneurs.
Do you cut and paste that back into your elevator pitch, or do you restructure it somehow?
Yeah, case by case, but I think in this case, we basically your own social network for anything, or your own social network is the high concept pitch. And a little bit of it is kind of it's as easy as starting a blog, a little bit, just via metaphor. But it's mostly cut and paste. Do it based on the situation, but in this case, it was cut and paste. Questions? Let's talk a little bit about decks. Thank you for the question earlier. A deck is a... Good. A deck is just a short PowerPoint presentation about your company that provides more details than your elevator pitch does. It's not absolutely critical, but people will probably ask you for one. It's an industry norm to attach one. It shows that you've thought about the business, and you're going to need something like a deck for when you actually pitch investors. You probably will want to work one up or work one up just in time when people ask for it, though you'll probably, just work one up just in time. I'm not going to spend too much time on decks. Here are the general things you'll find in a deck, and this is the order that I like, and you'll find other templates out there. Use this one. It's based on David Cowan's template, which I think is the best. And the story roughly goes like this.
we have this great team who has found this specific problem and we're solving it with this amazing product with this technology inside. We are going to bring it to market, we're going to distribute it like this, and we're going to charge, we're going to make money off of it like this with these advantages over our competition. And in conclusion, here's our plans for the next few quarters. And in conclusion, this is a great financing opportunity. That's the rough story that you tell in a day. If you want the details of what goes inside each of these sections, I would say we've got a blog post on this. You can check that out. Or you can buy the book, but most of the stuff is on the blog anyway. The other thing I would say, don't take this sequence too literally. While I suggest taking the elevator pitch pretty literally and copying it, I see people copying this way too literally. So it depends on the situation. You want to tailor your actual physical presentation when you're presenting to people based on the exact situation. So, for example, if you have 5 minutes to demo at a conference, you're not going to do this. If you're meeting one-on-one with an investor and it's just the two of you, my preference would not be to bring out a deck. My preference would be to have a conversation with the guy and have some visual aids that you bring out along the way. If you're going to present to a full partnership with 10 people in the audience, then you're probably going to want to do a formal presentation. So use this. I would cover all these topics, but don't take this sequence too literally. This is where your ability to really actually weave a story and also present it in person comes into play. One approach that I see taken that I like a lot is absolutely necessary is to demo up front. Even if you think they've seen the product before, show them the product your way. So one approach you can take is to introduce yourself briefly, demo the product, then jump into this sequence where you talk about the team and talk a little bit about the problem and the solution. But if you don't demo your product up front, that's all people want to see. And there's way too much tension associated. They're not going to be paying attention if they're wondering what the product is. A couple more things on decks. The art of presenting in person is, to some degree, an art. And it takes a long time to learn, I think. A lot of the things that I've shown in this presentation, you can do basically overnight, right? There's things you can craft in the background. But the art of actually presenting in person, some people have it, you know, they're born with it, perhaps, or they learn it along the way. And if you don't, it takes a long time to learn it. And, you know, compare Obama in 2004 to Obama in 2008, or compare Steve Jobs, his first Mac pitch when he first debuted the Mac, to the way he pitches now. The first pitch was good, but the change is huge. And it's a bit of an art form. So there's a couple ways to approach it if you don't have it. One is start to slowly build it up. And there's a great blog post by Jason Calacanis called How to Demo Your Startup. You can find it on his blog or on TechCrunch, parts 1 and 2. Those are some good ideas on how to pitch in person. The other approach you can take is to partner with someone who is compelling in person. So that's the approach I tend to take. I usually like to work with people who are naturally salesy. And by salesy, I don't mean they're like an enterprise bag-carrying salesman. I just mean they're compelling in the way that, for example, Bill Gates is compelling, right? He's nerdy, but compelling. And compelling means the people that were in the audience or in the meeting, they walk out of it saying, oh, geez, what the hell just happened? And I want to be a part of that. The last thing I would say is, I'm not going to talk about it. If you really care about decks, Steve Blank has this thing that he calls a lessons learned deck, which you can learn a little bit more about. He basically, I think rightly so, says that this generic approach that you see put out by people like me and others is kind of crappy. And he has a more experimental approach to pitching, where he talks about, here are the hypotheses we had. Here's how we tested them. Here are the results we expected. Here are the results we actually had. Here's the next hypothesis we generated. And then you just repeat that cycle. And that cycle covers your problem, solution, technology, marketing, sales, and competition. all in one, and you go through that cycle several times in a pitch. So I'm actually learning a little bit about that type of pitching myself right now. So I don't know enough about it to tell you much about it, but you can look it up yourself. His name is Steve Blank. Any questions? Yep.
So there's always like the cliche hockey stick curve when it comes to like revenue projections or sales projections, right?
Yeah.
And I've heard some investors will say that whenever they look at like a revenue projection, first of all, like they don't believe it. And if they want to look at it, they basically cut the y-axis by a factor of 5 and they double the time.
Okay.
I mean, is it one of those things where it's like a game of cat and mouse where the entrepreneurs kind of know that, so then they inflate their figures and the investors then, I mean, what's your thoughts on how do you project numbers in a way that's still going to be keep their attention?
Yeah. I guess I would say, I'm not sure there's a straightforward answer to it. It depends on the stage of the startup. My general advice would be that if you don't already have some numbers, one, and some insight as to how they are going to grow, if you don't have some specific insight, don't make stuff up. Don't even put together the projections. Don't even bother. One. And for early stage startups, you really don't need them. Two, I think you want to have just a top-down and bottom-up understanding of what the market looks like. So the top-down is the generic billion-dollar market approach. And if you want to be more insightful than that, learn a little bit about market type, which you can learn about from Steve Blank, which is really, really interesting. Model of learning about existing markets, resegmenting markets, and new markets. So learn about that. If you go talk to an investor about what type of market you're in, you will sound like a genius without having any specific figures. So that, and then on the bottom up side, you just want to have a good understanding of the microeconomics of your business, right? So for example, we think we can get ads that cost this dollar amount, this CPM. We know we can get these kinds of conversions and so on. So some understanding of the microeconomics of your business. So I think the macroeconomics, microeconomics, and market type together, they are static figures. They don't have any change in time. But I think with those, you'll sound much more intelligent than you would by presenting a generic curve that looks like this, and we're at $50 million in revenue in 5 years. Any sophisticated investor doesn't even bother with that. You look less sophisticated by presenting that than you would by taking a perhaps more thoughtful approach. So I wouldn't even get into the cat and mouse game. For a later stage company, that's a different story. I've never really been involved or raised capital for a later stage business, so I won't comment. But at that point, you basically have some understanding of the economics of the business. Did I answer your question? Is there another question? That's the past. Okay. Business plans. Nobody reads them. Nobody executes them. Don't bother. Charles River says the best way to get our attention is not with a 100-page business plan. Like I said, some investors will ask for them. They tend to be the least sophisticated types of investors. And I'm not saying not to have plans or not to document them. Anywhere, you can put them on a napkin, on your wiki, in a spreadsheet, and you should share them with your investors and get some general agreement on the plans around the time of your second and third meetings, and perhaps more importantly, have some understanding of your meta plans, that is to say, how you are going to evaluate the hypotheses in the plan and how you are going to generate new ones based on the results of those experiments. But don't send investors a 50-page business plan, which is just a sales pitch for your business. Likewise, with an executive summary, just a elevator pitch and a deck are sufficient. The last topic is NDAs. Does anybody care about NDAs, or do you want me to just skip it? The short answer on NDAs is no one will sign one. The reason behind it is it's just impractical for investors, and two, investors want to reserve the right to invest in your competition. They just because the market timing is right, a lot of competitive startups tend to get started at the same time, and investors want to reserve the right, like I said, to invest in your competition. What I would assume is anything you send in, first of all, don't send anything that you have to keep secret to investors. Don't mention it in person. Don't mention it to anybody in person. Or don't put it in writing either and send it to anyone other than your lawyers. The other thing I would assume is that as soon as you send something in writing to investors, I would assume that it's going to get on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. I would also understand that nobody cares enough about your company to put it there. I would also assume that it's going to get into the hands of your competition. Lots of decks get into the hands of the competition. I've seen it happen personally to friends of mine. And you know, other people have told me about how it's happened to them. So whatever you put in writing, assume it's going to get into the hands of the competition. Also understand that that doesn't really mean much for a couple of reasons. One, as you guys already know, ideas are worthless by themselves, right? You need to execute on them. Two, execution by itself is also worthless. Without an approach, a thoughtful approach to revise your hypotheses and execute on new ones in the future or very quickly, you're going to end up executing on the wrong path. So let me give you a specific example. A friend of mine talks about a successful friend of mine talks about a deck that he had circulated to VCs, which ended up directly into the hands of his competition. The competition started executing on the deck, and you know, my friend didn't really care because after 3 months, he decided that the stuff on the deck was stupid, and he was executing on a new plan. And 3 months after that, he was probably executing on a new plan as well. So while his competition was still linearly executing on the original deck that they'd gotten from my friend. So it's execution and revision of execution that determines success in most startups. And I'll just give you my coordinates again. VentureHex.com @VentureHex, and you can feel free to email me. And last quote from my friend Eric Ries, which I like a lot. Every startup has a chance to change the world by bringing not just a new product, but an entirely new institution into existence. So any questions or comments or anyone want to disagree with me on any of this? Yeah.
How important are patents to intellectual property?
Yeah. Steve Blank has a good phrase that he teaches here at Stanford in the B School and in the Engineering School and at Berkeley and Columbia and other places. And and he says the answer to every question in business school is it depends. And it's mostly right. It depends is a good answer to every question in business school. So it depends. It depends a lot on the vertical market that you're in. So in the markets that I have experience in, which is mostly consumer internet and a little bit of enterprise software, in consumer internet, patent protection is bordering on irrelevant. On enterprise software, it's useful defensively, perhaps. And then in other industries, which I don't know much about, but I'll comment anyway, it's critical, like biotech and potentially green tech. So it depends on the industry. So the best approach there is to work with an advisor who is experienced in your field. Actually, work with multiple advisors who are experienced with your field, in your field, and definitely do not listen to what your lawyers say. You know, your lawyers, I don't mean in all things. I just mean lawyers can tell you what the rules of the game are, but they can't tell you how to play the game. Advisors can tell you how to play the game. Lawyers will always argue for the worst case. You know, any mildly successful entrepreneur will tell you that if we followed all the rules, we would have never gotten anywhere. So that's the case for like companies like Kiva or PayPal, or especially in the consumer internet, you tend to be more reactionary. So when the assistant district attorney contacts you and tells you that you have, you know, child molesters on your website, then you do something about it, but you don't really try to be too preventative about it. That said, don't break the law. Okay. And did I answer your question about patents? Okay. Questions?
Could you give us the elevator pitch for Songbird?
Oh, the elevator pitch for Songbird off the top of my head? Well, I can give you the high concept pitch. I can try to put together an elevator pitch. Let's see.
Let's see. So before we raised money, we'd released the 0.1, and 100,000 people had downloaded it. So we had something to show, and we had good traction. We had good traction. Why did we build it? We built it because we felt that media players should be as open as the web is. So with a web browser, you can go to any website in the world. But with a media player, the most prevalent one being iTunes, you can only go to one website in the world, the iTunes Music Store, and you can only sync it to one device. So we felt you should be able to sync it to any device or stream to any device and get content from anywhere in the world. So that was kind of the vision around it. What is the product description? It's the Firefox of media players, and I'm having trouble elaborating on that. It's like an open version of iTunes. Imagine a version of iTunes that let you get content from Last.fm or Pandora and sync it to your BlackBerry or stream it to your Sling player. I don't know, this is pretty generic. Did I miss anything? Is that good or okay?
How do you make money?
How do you make money? Oh, yeah.
Or is that not needed anymore?
No. It depends on the stage of the business, right? Good point. So that would go on traction, right? If you're making money. So if you're not making money right now, it can be a sentence like up here maybe or here. So in the case of Songbird, the short pitch, I don't think we ever really put this in any kind of elevator pitch, but the short description was, we're going to monetize search in the same exact way that Firefox has a relationship with Google. We are going to have a media search relationship with the right partner or a whole host of partners and have many integration points beyond just a search box.
How does this game plan change when you are playing, when you are pitching for social entrepreneurship? Because you have a lot of social impact to assess and then the profit side of it and the social impact. So then how do the investors decide on that?
I don't know anything about social entrepreneurship. I'm not even sure what exactly it means. So feel free to educate me or the crew. As far as impact goes, I think you can use all the same stuff here. And as your colleague wisely pointed out, there's nothing in here about making money anyway. So I think you can basically use this. I don't know if I really answered your question. I'm not, like I said, I don't know. Can you tell me what social entrepreneurship is about? Or
think people and profit. So it's like you actually can help people's lives in certain ways, like either health or education or in anything.
Yeah.
And the idea is that you're trying to bring kind of the for-profit entrepreneurial type, you know, techniques and mindset, but you're doing it from a social impact.
Yeah. I think most good companies or a lot of good, at least especially like the big vision, put a dent in the world kind of companies, that a lot of which comprise a large portion of the companies that get funded out here, all have positive social impact already. Apple has positive social impact, right? They make these great things that make our lives better. So I don't see why, if the company's for profit, I really wouldn't change the pitch.
It's a different thing. Like you have this Kiva or you have this Grameen Bank in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
They are not like Apple.
Yeah.
Like, you use it brings your makes your life better, but it's at the end of the day something like it's more about commodity use, what Apple does.
I think Kiva is a non-profit for sure, but okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Like, but still, they have a direct impact on the lot more direct impact on the lives of the people, and especially people who are a lot more.
I think that's debatable.
Okay, so. I'm just giving some examples of Grameen Bank, which is more of a social entrepreneurship rather than just so the aim is to be profitable, but at the same time, the prime motive is just not profit-making, but also making an impact and changing lives of the people for the better, especially for the very poor section of the society.
Yeah.
Or addressing a very pressing issue, like even environment or something, which affects rich and poor in equal amount.
Yeah, so instead of being difficult, let me try to be helpful instead. I think I would just take what you said and maybe have a paragraph. I mean, the first thing I do is just have a paragraph about that. And you said having an impact on people's lives. What was it?
It was roughly, how are we going to impact the lives of people and make them better? People who are not well-to-do or not so well-off, and improve their lives. So I would have a sentence or two about that, right? The impact that you can have on the lives of X. And put that in here, maybe, into the high concept. That's just my first thought. I don't know if that helped or not.
No.
Sure. Any other questions? Anyone want to disagree with any of this? Any experiences that you want to share? Okay, cool. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.